Baruch Shechianu v'kimanu v'gianu lazman hazeh. Welcome to a new zman of Machshava. And we begin our new zman with a continuation of our old topic. The last two shiurim, we have been talking about Bechiras Yisrael. And today I'd like to focus on three related thinkers on this topic. Until now, we've discussed the idea more generally. Now we're going to focus on the Mahalich of specific thinkers. We're going to start with Kuzari, then we're going to move on to Maharal and conclude with Rav Kook. In your source sheets, it's the same source sheets as last time. Kuzari is where we got up to. You'll see after the Kuzari in the source sheets is the Rambam. Maybe we'll do that next week, I'm not sure, but afterwards you could skip down to Maharal and Rav Kook, which is what we'll be doing next. So just a bit of background on Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. I should say at the beginning that there are aspects of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's Shita, as well as the other thinkers we're going to think today, that we're going to see today, that are somewhat controversial, and not everything that they say is mainstream. I think often their views are somewhat understood superficially and misrepresented. So our job is to try to understand what they're saying. A little bit of background about Kuzari. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi wrote a book, officially, the actual title of the book is The Book of Argument of Proof in Defense of the Despised Faith. It was written in Arabic. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lived in Spain, though tradition has it that he moved to Eretz Yisrael at the end of his life, where he was killed outside the city gate of Yerushalayim. The book of Kuzari discusses a story that took place in the 8th century. In other words, this story had reached Spain, where Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lived in the 10th century. That's when the people of Spain heard about the story. It had happened 2 centuries earlier. And the story is basically true. We don't know much about it, that the king of the Khazars, along with much of his nation, converted to Judaism. The Khazar people lived on the shores of the Caspian Sea. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi presents the dialogue, the story that might have motivated the Khazar king to convert. In other words, he wasn't there. He doesn't know what actually happened. So it's the background is real, but the presentation is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's imagination. But really what it is it's a format to be able to discuss basic ideas in Judaism in a question-answer type format, in a conversational format, which makes it particularly interesting. So the legend is that the king of the Khazars had a dream in which he was told that your way of thinking is pleasing to your creator, but not your way of acting. So he convenes a meeting, a debate. Initially, actually, the Jewish position isn't sought. After all, they are a despised faith who would be interested in Judaism. But he invites a Christian priest, a Islamic priest or imam, and a Aristotelian philosopher. And after not too much time, the king realizes that, well, Christianity and Islam are built upon Judaism, so maybe we should actually invite a rabbi, or what he calls the chaver, a Jewish sage, and he does. The king is convinced of the correctness of Judaism, and he converts. That's described at the beginning of book 2. The entire work is 5 books. And for the rest of the book, the chaver is teaching him all about Torah and Judaism. And at the end, actually, of the 5th book, the Chaver says he's leaving to Eretz Yisrael. So there are many issues discussed in the Kuzari, but we're going to focus on the idea of Bechiras Yisrael. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is really, as we'll see, a very, very influential thinker in this realm. To begin, we have to before the Kuzari talks about why or the nature of who we are and why we were chosen, he gives us a little bit of important background, which is, what is the essence of our obligation to serve God? And he writes that it's rooted in personal revelation. God spoke to us and commanded the Torah. This is an idea that really there are earlier thinkers that stress this. In Emunos Videos, for example, it talks about this, but Yehuda Levi develops the idea, though now is not the time to discuss it, that it's quite significant that Judaism is the only religion which is built off of mass revelation. No other religion is predicated upon that. And that's because, he says, for an obvious reason, nobody, if they were making up a religion, could get away with it. They couldn't say all of you or all of your ancestors experienced revelation and they were told to pass on this message to you. So Judaism, though, is, and that shows that it's true. And so he writes like this. So we're in Mamar Aleph Per Chaf Hei. Mashani Chayav Bo, the Chayavim Bo Kol Kehal Yisrael, that which I'm obligated to do, and all of Kehal Yisrael is obligated to do, Asher Yisparer Etzlam HaMa'amad HaHu B'Biros Einehem, V'Achar Kein HaKabbalah HaNimsheches Shehi K'mare HaAyin. That it was clear to all of Kehal Yisrael because they saw it, they witnessed it, it was personal revelation at Sinai. And then that tradition was passed on, and that tradition is Kemar HaAyin, because they were told to each one of them to remember this event and to pass it on. So the king now says, well, does that imply that only Jews who experienced revelation have to serve God? And the Chaver says, yes. Amar Chaver, Amnam Kain. Kol mi shenilve aleinu min ha'umos ki yachid yevi'uhu min ha'tov asher yitav imanu ha'aloka. So in Achanami, only Jews who experience this revelation have to serve God in this way. But the truth is, anybody else who joins us will be able to participate, to share in this good fortune. Aval shaveh lo yishveh lanu. But he won't be the same. In other words, yes, you could convert. But even after converting, you're not the same. And this is actually one of the most controversial ideas that the Kuzari says over here. I will return to discuss that a little later. Kilo haya chayav chiyuv haTorah mitzad ma shaloka baras kulanu. If the obligation for Torah was rooted in creation, so then hayu shavim bo kol bnei adam, then all people would be equal because they're all equally created. Kelavan kishachor, whether white or black. Kikulam bru'av yisbarach, they're all created by God. Ulam chiyuv haTorah aleinu hu mitzad ma shotzianu haloka mimitzrayim hu mitzad hayos lo hischabrus imanu. But the basis of the obligation is God's having taken out us out of Egypt and connected to us in prophecy. Bioseinu skulas bnei adam, for we are the treasure of people, of mankind. So the king is a bit offended by the Chaver's claim that they're the pick of all of mankind. Roe ani ha-Yehudi mitapech b'dvarecha, ki acharei asher kvar haya ma'amarcha na'eh, Shavlios pagum. You started off saying very good, but now what you're saying really is very, very unpleasant. So the Chaver then justifies the distinction between Jew and non-Jew by describing a hierarchy in creation. This is a bit Aristotelian, this type of hierarchy, which we'll actually appoint, we'll get back to a little bit later. But there's an added level. In other words, there is mineral, plant, animal, man, right? That's the basic four-part categorization of the universe that the king agrees to. And then the Chaver asks him, well, what if there's a level that exists above man? So the king says, there's no such level. And the Chaver then basically describes Moshe. So here we are at Mem Aleph through Mem Gimel. Now, maybe I'll just read this in English, right? You have the English here. The English isn't a great translation, but the fact is that the Hebrew isn't the original either. So we'll just read the English. So the Chavar says like this: if we were to find a man who walks into fire without hurt, or abstains from food, or for some time without starving, on whose face a light shines that the eye cannot bear, who is never ill nor ages, until having reached his life's natural end, who dies spontaneously just as a man retires to his couch to sleep on an appointed day and hour, equipped with a knowledge of what is hidden as to past and future, is such a degree not visibly distinguished from the ordinary human degree? So the king responds, yes. This is the angelic degree, if it exists at all. It belongs to the province of the divine influence, but not that of the intellectual, human, or natural world. So maybe if such a thing exists, he's saying it's a malach, but it's not shayach to our world. So the Chavar tells him, these are some of the characteristics of the undoubted prophet through whom God himself manifest, and who also made known that there is a God who guides them as he wishes according to their obedience or disobedience. He revealed to this prophet that which was hidden and taught them how the world was created. So what the Chavar is saying is that Moshe's level is categorically different than the four preceding levels. So the Chavar has basically established that there's a fifth level of creation, the level of a prophet. Now the question is, how does that relate to the question that he was asked, right? Remember, what was the question? The question is, in what way are the Jewish people skulam mikol ha'amim? So the answer, it would seem, is that Rabbi Yehuda Levi maintains that only Jews experience prophecy. And while not every Jew can experience, actualizes that potential, every Jew whose ancestor received this revelation at Sinai inherits the potential for prophecy and therefore is categorically different. So what's he saying? Again, there's a fifth rung in creation, right? There's minimal, plant, animal, human, and Jew. And what distinguishes the Jew, the Kuzari explains, from everything else, is what he calls the Inyan Eloki, the divine influence, which allows for prophecy. Now, the question is, what does this term mean, Inyan Eloki? And we'll see that he uses this term very, very frequently, sometimes translated as a divinity or divine influence. What exactly does it mean? It's very hard to define. But before we actually define it, let's ask a very, very basic question about it. So we said before that Inyan Eloki, which is what makes Jews distinct, is associated with prophecy. So what does that mean in our world? In other words, what does that mean in the post-prophetic world? None of us are prophets. Does that mean that we don't have the Inyan Eloki, or the Inyan Eloki isn't relevant anymore? Even when there was prophecy, most Jews weren't prophets. So what exactly does this mean? So I think the answer, well, let's say it like this. I think you could say two possibilities, two ways. One possibility is that prophecy should be seen as an expression of a broader phenomenon, which is relating to God spiritually. So the Inyan Eloki allows a person to experience the divine, not just through the rational experiential means, but also through an extraordinary inner sense. Now, if that possibility, the first possibility, is correct, then Inyan Eloki is still relevant even in the post-prophetic world. The ultimate, the sea, the apex of the Inyan Eloki, which is actual prophecy, is not really shaykh to us, but the idea of the Inyan Eloki, which is relating to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this spiritual manner, is still shaykh to us. That's possibility one. Possibility two is to say no. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's focus on prophecy should be understood simply and narrowly, in which case Inyan Eloki is no longer particularly significant as long as there's no prophecy. So, of course, we long for the restoration of prophecy, and the theoretical ability to have prophecy might have some ramifications. But at present, the Inyan Eloki really has no relevance. So those are the two tzadim, right? What does he mean by Inyan Eloki? So first of all, a raya for the second tzad is that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, as we already saw, and as we'll continue to see, stresses prophecy almost to the exclusion of other phenomena. And moreover, even though you'll say, but you know, for 1,000 years before the Kuzari was written, there was no prophecy. Does that mean that Kuzari basically thought that Judaism in his time was dead? So the truth is actually, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says exactly that. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in Mamar Beis Parak, section Chaf Ches through Lamed, says an incredible thing. He compares the Jewish people in exile to those who are dead, to the dried out bones of Yechezkel. You remember the famous prophecy of the bones in Yechezkel, in which the prophet goes out and he sees this big field with scattered dried out bones. So who are those dried out bones? So the Kuzari says those dried out bones are us in Galus, where we're dead. And then the prophet Yechezkel is told to prophesy about the bones, and he prophesies their resurrection. The bones indeed come back to life. So what does that symbolize? So the Kuzari says that symbolizes the Geula. It's not just that the Kuzari that learns the prophecy that way, the Ramban does in Parshas Vayechi. The Ramban even says that what's the Maisa Avo Simin Labanim of Yaakov dying in Mitzrayim? That Klal Yisrael are going to die in Galus. And what's the Maisa Avo Simin Labanim of Yaakov Avinu being brought back to Eretz Yisrael dead? That's the Geula, where we're brought back to Eretz Yisrael having died in Galus. So what does it mean we die in Galus, right? We're not dead. Klal Yisrael will never be wiped out. The answer is that spiritually, we're dead. The Gra also learns those psukim that way. So this is quite extraordinary, right? And that's exactly what the Kuzari says. It's hard to imagine. We don't feel like we're dead. But the Kuzari says that's just because we don't know what it's like to be alive. We'll read it again inside. So the Chavar says, it is true that the source of wisdom, the Ten Commandments, rested in the Ark, and the Ark is analogous to the heart and not the head. The Ten Commandments were broken down into 613 mitzvos, which is why the Torah scroll rested next to the Luchos. However, from there two wisdoms emerged, the wisdom of the Torah and its sustainers, the Kohanim, and the wisdom of prophecies and its sustainers, the prophets. These two groups of people became the cognizant advisors who exhorted and reminded the nation. They then represented the head of the nation. So the king says, if so, it would seem that today you are a body without a head and without a heart. And the Chavar says back, you're right. Moreover, we have no real bones, just scattered bones akin to the dry bones of Yechezkel. Nevertheless, King the Khazars, these bones have some remnant of life in them, for they were utensils for the head, heart, life, force, spirit, and soul. They are therefore better than the intact bodies whose head, eyes, ears, and remaining parts are made of stone and plaster. These bodies never had the spirit of life rest within them, nor is it possible that they ever will. Rather, they are forms that resemble man, but not really man. So here too, I think, it sounds like the second option is correct. In other words, there is little left of our uniqueness besides our glorious past and the fact that we are once alive and also that once again we will live. What's interesting, though, is that the king notes that this is really what allowed us to remain distinct throughout the bitter exile. He says, the king says, this is true. It's inconceivable any other nation would be able to retain its identity in exile without eventually being assimilated into its parent culture, and certainly not after such a long period of time. Look how many nations who arose after the Jewish nation have been lost to history without even a memory remaining, including Edom, Moab, Ammon, Aran, the Plishtim, the Chaldeans, the Medians, the Persians, Yavan, the Barmians, the Sabians, and many others, right? In other words, it's quite a remarkable thing he's noting, the ability for the Jewish people to remain a distinct nation in exile. And so he says, yeah, you have a great past, you have a great future. But again, where does that leave us now? Are we nothing more than dried out bones waiting for redemption? Or is there something of significance that we still have? So at this point, Reb Yudah Levi introduces another aspect of our singularity, one which remains today and is very important. So the Chavar says, do not think that because I conceded to your words earlier, this means we are like a dead object. Rather, we are attached to the divinity by way of the mitzvos, through which God made a covenant between ourselves and him. There is circumcision, of which it said, my covenant shall be on your flesh for an everlasting covenant. There's Shabbos. It is a sign between me and you throughout our generations, your generations. In other words, here, Reb Yudah Levi is saying that there is a, through covenantal mitzvos, we continue to connect to the Ribono Shel Olam, even in the post-prophetic world. In other words, not all is lost. And later in the book, in the fifth book, Reb Yudah Levi again turns to the significance of the observance of mitzvos. This is a complicated paragraph, but basically he's talking about the principle for understanding and observing the Torah. So he writes, the fourth principle expresses the conviction that existing beings are of higher and lower degree. Everything that is processed of feeling and perception is higher than those creatures which lack the same. This, since the former are nearer to the degree of the prime cause, who himself is the intellect. You see here, he's using, again, a very Aristotelian formulation in terms of describing the universe. The lowest plant occupies a higher rank than the noblest mineral. The lowest animal is higher than the noblest plant, and the lowest human being is higher than the noblest animal. Likewise, the lowest follower of the divine law occupies a higher place than the noblest person without mitzvos. For the divine law confers something of the nature of malachim on the human mind, a thing that cannot be acquired otherwise. The proof is that the prolonged practice of this law leads to a degree of prophetic inspiration, of which there is no nearer degree to God for man. An observer of mitzvos that sins is therefore greater than one who lacks mitzvos, because the divine law empowered him to lead an angelic life and to reach the degree of angels. Even if his sin sullied and defaced his stature, some traces will always remain, and the fire of his longing for it is not quite extinguished. If he had his own choice, he would prefer to remain untutored, just as a sick and pain-plagued person would not prefer to be a horse, fish, or bird, which, though happy and free from pain, is far removed from reason that brings near to the divine degree. So what's he saying over here? Again, he's looking at the universe in this hierarchy, minerals, plants, animals, human beings, and then the fifth level is the Jew. But over here, you see he's focusing on mitzvos as opposed to prophecy. He mentioned that mitzvos could bring a person towards prophecy, but it's mitzvos as well. So I don't think there's a stira. There actually are some scholars who think that this is a stira. He changed his mind after the first book, and what he's saying over here in the fifth book is a different view. I don't think there's evidence or sufficient evidence for that. I think what he's saying is, and there was a key line over there, he's saying that mitzvos can bring a person to prophecy, and the potential for prophecy is something that's very significant in and of itself, even if it's not actualized. In other words, there's two issues, right? There's two issues. One is potential for prophecy, and here he's explaining how the potential is actualized, right? And how is it actualized? Through doing mitzvos. So they're linked, like we said, because mitzvos could lead to prophecy. So that's significant, even if the ultimate goal of prophecy is never really achieved. And we connect, he says, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through mitzvos. And that's true even without prophecy. So if we go back, and you see this also in the first book, going back to book one, Kuf Tes Vav, when someone clings to these ways, meaning mitzvos, he and his offspring will enjoy a large degree of closeness to God. Nevertheless, a convert is still not equal to a Jew who is born into the faith, because only a Jew can achieve prophecy. Converts can accomplish their purpose by accepting the word of God from the prophets and becoming wise and saintly, but they themselves cannot become prophets. So even though they could do mitzvos, it can't bring them to prophecy. Now you see something else here as well, which is that he said before that converts can become wise and saintly. They could be, in the Hebrew, chachamim v'chasidim. So even without prophecy, you could become a chacham and a chassid. You just can't become a navi. And likewise, therefore, in the post-prophetic world, we can all become chachamim and chassidim, even though we can't become neviim. So I think what two things emerge. First of all, I think the first option that we said before is correct, but at the same time, the second is also true. Clearly, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi believes that our connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is severely weakened. Right, even if we're not at the level of a corpse, like he says, we're at the level of a very sick person who's wasting away, and doctors have given up hope. Yechezkel himself says, you know, can these bones live? If you remember, we talked about a couple of weeks ago the suffering servant. So he actually invokes that. He says that we are that servant that we can't even see their humanity. So maybe, I guess, if you wish, going back to Achakir, it's something in between the two options that we said before. In other words, in Galus, we do continue to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through mitzvos, and the uniqueness of our stature is not totally obsolete, but we're certainly a shadow of our former self. So that's the idea of the Inyan Eloki. And he says that's what makes Jews distinct from the rest of the world. So how did we go to the Inyan Eloki? Yeah, there's some questions. Are there questions? Please.
Yeah. So according to the Kuzari over here, he would be saying that in Galus nowadays, since we don't have that level of prophecy, there would be no difference between a convert and someone who was born Jewish?
So it's an interesting question. Perhaps there's no practical difference, but there is a difference in their potential. But you're right that the difference is less significant, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I really, and how are we describing prophecy? How are we defining prophecy? Like, what can we define it? Can we, like, it's coming up over and over and over again, but like, what can we, like, what is it?
And it's most basic level. It's hearing Hashem talking to you and understanding Hashem talking to you. Obviously there's a lot more. The Rambam Nevuchim writes, there's 10 levels of prophecy and 2 levels of pre-prophecy. And he goes and describes what each one is. So prophecy is many different things, but in its most basic level, it's Hashem talking to you. Nowadays, if somebody said, God spoke to me and I heard it, we would think they're a Meshugana. Yes, Eitan.
Yeah. Also, how would the Kuzari explain like the Mefurish examples in Chumash of non-Jews having prophecy?
It's a great question. I hope we can get back to that at the end. Very bekitzer. So the Mefurish example that you have, that the only problematic one is really Bilam, probably, because as we'll see in a moment, it was only after Yaakov that only Jews alone exclusively had the Inyan Eloki. As we'll see in a moment, Noach, Shase, Adam, right? They weren't Jewish, though they had Inyan Eloki. Avadia was Jewish. He prophesied to the non-Jews. He was a Jewish Navi that spoke to non-Jews. So Bilam,
wasn't it Ger?
Oh, so Ger is a different issue. We could talk about Ger, but that's not the question here wasn't Chazal, it was Psukim. Are there Psukim against him? There are Midrashim against him. And we could talk about those as well. I don't think the Psukim say that Avadia was a Ger. Maybe we could check that up. So in terms of Bilam, you could say for the Kuzari that before he was already a prophet before Matan Torah. It could also be like Rashi said that what he did wasn't a high degree of prophecy. Rambam actually says that. Rambam didn't need to say it. Rambam says explicitly that non-Jews could be prophets. He writes that. He disagrees with the Kuzari. So the Rambam himself says that Bilam wasn't a prophet. What he experienced before he sinned was one of the 2 levels of pre-prophecy. So we could get back to that. In terms of Avadia, I don't know. I think he would probably say that his position is not like that view in Chazal, but I'm not sure. As you know, maybe I'll briefly mention it now. I'd like to elaborate a little more in a couple minutes. But even among the thinkers that adopt a Kuzari-like approach to Bechiras Yisrael, what do I mean by a Kuzari-like approach? That there is something metaphysically different between the Jew and the non-Jew. The Jewish neshama is different than the non-Jewish neshama. And a manifestation of that might be prophecy. Even among the many thinkers that adopt that perspective, many, many, if not most, disagree with his conclusion about Gerim. And they maintain that a Ger gets a Jewish soul. Either he always had it, or he gets a new neshama when he converts or the like. We'll get back to that a little bit later. But it is worthwhile to note that. So while many subsequent thinkers adopt the Kuzari's Mahalich about the special Jewish neshama, I think most don't accept his position on Geiras. Let's go back to though the Kuzari for a moment. So how did this all come about? So how did how did this all start? So let's go back again to the first book, Aleph Tzadi Hei. So what makes the Jewish people essentially different from the rest of the world? We saw that's Inyan Eloki. So why does God make the Jewish people different? So the Kuzari says, let's go back to the beginning of time, Parshas HaShavua. So Kuzari writes, Adam merited to have the Nyan Eloki. Adam was perfect in every way possible for a human, because no flaw could be found in a work of a wise almighty creator, wrought from substance chosen by him and fashioned according to his own design. Adam HaRishon was direct Yetzir Kapa of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so he was perfect in these respects. Which respects? So he mentions three things. There was no restraining influence because of the seed of the father or the blood of the mother. No question of nutrition or education during the years of childhood and growth. Neither was there the influence of climate, water, or soil to consider. In other words, these are all factors that sometimes make chesronos in people. Their nature, their nurture, their environment, things like that. Adam had none of these chesronos. Why? So the Kuzari continues, for he was created, for Hashem created him in the form of an adult, perfect in body and mind. The living soul which he was endowed was perfect. That's number one. Number two, his intellect was the loftiest possible for a human being to possess. And number three, and beyond this, he was gifted with a divine power of such high rank that it brought him into connection with beings divine and spiritual and enabled him with slight reflection to comprehend the truths without instruction. We call him Ben Elohim, and we call those that are like him B'nai Elohim, which is in this week's parsha. It's an interesting way of understanding that section. So again, Adam, he says, was perfect in three ways with respect to his soul, his intellect, and his inyan Eloki, his divine influence. Now, all humans possess the first of these two elements. They got that from Adam and Chava. But the third is limited. And as we'll see, he treats the inyan Eloki almost like a genetic trait. And just like, you know, if you remember back to what you learned in biology in ninth grade, right? So you could have seeds and their characteristics that sometimes the parents will have and the offspring won't have. Sometimes the offspring, and then it'll appear later, right? It'll come back in a later generation. It seems to skip generations. It's there in a latent form, like a recessive gene, which then can come back later. So basically what he says, maybe, you know, we're running a little late, so we won't read it inside, but that's the idea of how the Inyan Eloki was transferred. So not all of Adam's children had it. Cain didn't have it. Sorry, and when Cain killed Hevel, so then there was no one that had it. Chase was born later, and he had it. And from Chase, it was passed on to Enosh, and eventually to Noach. And like you said before, these are called the B'nai Elohim. And that's basically how things went on to Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu's father didn't have it, right? But it was passed on through Avram Avinu's father to him. Avram had two children. One did, one didn't. Yitzchak had two children. One did, one didn't. Yaakov, though, was quite significant because all of his children had the Inyan Eloki. And that was a transformation. Everything changed after Yaakov. All of his descendants had this trait. Now, doesn't mean that all of his descendants would always be great, but they all have the ability, the potential for greatness, the potential to be prophets, the Inyan Eloki. It reminds me of Avart. Somebody just reminded me today from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. The Shulchan Aruch says, Rama says that even though technically it's mutter to nurse from a non-Jewish woman, but ideally, you shouldn't allow your kid to nurse from a non-Jewish woman for the same reason that Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't allowed to nurse from the Egyptian, because pashtid l'daber mashchina. In other words, we should raise our children with this awareness that they could become Nevi'im, that they become Nevi'im. And that's what he's saying. Every Jew, they might turn out good, they might turn out bad. We have free will, but they have in them the potential to become Nevi'im. They have within them that Inyan Eloki. And whether or not they actualize it, that's up to them. Yehuda Levi believes very much in Bechir Chavshis. He says later on in the book that someone who denies Bechira is a perverse hypocrite. And without undermining divine omniscience, Lemaitza, we do have Bechira Chavshis. And the Bechira manifests itself in our ability to realize that Inyan Eloki or not. So that's the idea. And again, we're not going to read a lot of these because though they're very important. But I want to sort of to think about a couple more things and then turn to the morale. So first question to think about is why is there a need for this hierarchy? Right? Basically, Yehuda Levi says that there are these two classes of people, those with the Inyan Eloki and those without. So the king actually asks him in Mamar Aleph Perek Kuf Beis, you know, why is there a need of this division? And he answers with a tricky answer. He says, would it not have been best for all animals to be able to speak? And then he goes in and sort of repeats the history. So what I think he's saying is that hierarchies are part of creation. Humans are more intelligent than animals. Among animals, there's degrees. There's higher intelligence and lower intelligence. Even among humans, some people are born with more strength or athleticism or ingenuity or musical talent or the like. These gifts are only meaningful when developed, but Rabbi Yehuda Levi is saying that the nature of the world is such that we're not all born on an equal playing field. And therefore, some humans are born with a higher spiritual capacity than others. And if you ask me, you know, why should that be? It's like saying, well, why can't a frog talk? That's the way of creation, that not everything is the same. I think that's basically what he's saying over here. And he actually elaborates. He says that the universe needs different creatures to perform different tasks. An ant shouldn't complain that he's not a monkey. And a cat shouldn't say it's unfair that I can't talk. And Rabbi Yehuda Levi says it doesn't make sense for a non-Jew to say, why can't I prophesy, or why don't I have the Inyan Eloki? And he actually compares Jews and non-Jews to different organs of a body. In other words, they are all humans, but you know, the Jewish people he compares to the heart among the other organs. So all the organs are valuable. Each of the specialized organs contributes to the body in a particular way. Some are even neshama tluya b'hem. They're necessary. If they're missing, the body would die or be incomplete. But the heart plays a particularly important role. It's indispensable. It brings power and life to the whole body. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Avraham Avinu. Through you, bracha will come to the whole world. So, and this actually relates back to what we talked about in the previous year of the Jews' responsibility towards the broader world, which Rabbi Yehuda Levi agrees to as well. Now, as we said before, Conversion, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi does say that the convert, again, because of his almost genetic type mahalich and looking at the Inyan Eloki, so the convert isn't born with Inyan Eloki, and therefore, like, though he could become a chassid and a chacham, he can't be a navi. That's basically what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says. So as I said before, many, even those who accept the basic mahalach of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi don't accept this point. So Rabbi Yosef, one possibility is, like we said, that that upon conversion, a convert gets a new neshama. Rabbi Yosef Engel actually has a different mahalach. He says that all converts were initially designated for conversion, and therefore they're born with that specialized soul. That would, Agam, I think, explain. There's an interesting Gemara that in Yivamos that says that converts are sometimes punished for not converting earlier because they have that special neshama. And one place where you might see that idea is the Gemara in Shavuos. The Gemara in Shavuos is explaining the pasuk in Parshas Netzavim, right? The pasuk says, "Lo eschem levadchem anochi karesin b'rizazos," right? "Ki es asher yeshno po." Ein li ala osan ha'omdim al har Sinai, doros habayim v'geirim asidim lezgariminayin. How do I know that geirim were included in this covenant? Talmud lomar v'esa sharinenu. So what do you see? That the neshamos of the geirim were also at Sinai. That's what the Gemara says. Or another Gemara in Shabbos says their mazel was at Sinai. So that might explain why, even if you take a Kuzari type mahalich, Gerim have the same type of neshama as Jews. Maybe just a concluding remark about the Kuzari, and then I want to look at some other thinkers. A number of years ago, I got a letter from, it was like a 10-page letter, from a very, very fascinating letter from a ger who lived in a different country. And he said, basically, I've learned the Kuzari and I want to know, is the Kuzari a racist? Is Rabbi Yehuda Halevi a racist? So it's a taka question that I think troubles a lot of people. Obviously, our job isn't to judge Rishonim, but maybe it's worthy of consideration. He asked the question. I think a lot of people have to ask this question. So it's interesting, right? A couple of weeks ago, we saw Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky also asked the question, and his answer was no. But part of the reason why the answer was no was because he said, well, anyone who wishes to convert can convert, and then they're entirely equal. So clearly it's not about race, right? But obviously that answer is not true for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, to a large degree, with respect to the Inyan Eloki, what matters is were you born with it or not. So as opposed to, let's say, the Rambam, who, and we'll talk about this next week, this is not so Pashut, but the Pashtus, the Rambam does sound like there's no inherent difference between a Jew and a non-Jew. He doesn't mention anywhere that a Jew is a different neshama. As I mentioned before, he thinks that non-Jews can prophesy. The Kuzari does seem to say does seem to be a racist theory. But I think there are some other things that should be kept in mind as well. First of all, like we've seen, inheriting the Inyan Eloki doesn't guarantee anything. The potential has to be actualized through hard work and dedication. Moreover, the Kuzari doesn't say that non-Jews are worthless. They He doesn't even say that there's no place for them to have a relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam. What he says, right, we saw, he said that when it comes to chasidus, when it comes to chachma, so that's something that's shayach, even without the Inyan Eloki. The Inyan Eloki is a special relationship between God and Jews. It's something that allows for prophecy. It allows for connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a particular way. But just because someone doesn't have the Inyan Eloki doesn't mean they can't be a tzaddik or a chacham or a chassid. So while it is true that there is a racial element, if you will, something that matter, you know, depends on what you're born with, it doesn't, A, it's only potential, it has to be actualized, and B, it doesn't deny the possibility of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through other means and achieving Kedusha or Tzidkus or Chasidus or Chachma, though it does mean that a certain thing can't be achieved. One last comment, which is something to think about. You know, but when we learn Rishonim, let's say, in Machshava, so you'll notice that certain aspects of what they say have sort of become accepted and part of, you know, mainstream, in other parts less so. And especially, you know, things that aspects of their mahalich that seem to be rooted not so much in Jewish sources, maybe more in contemporary sources. L'mashal l'ma davar doma. When you learn Rambam and you learn Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah is very, very important. And many aspects have certainly become, you know, central, basic ideas in Torah and Hashkafa. But other aspects of things that he says there, let's say his Aristotelian conception of the universe, you know, the idea that the planets sort of think, and his whole mahalich on the heavenly and the rotating spheres and things like that. So, you know, I think later thinkers, for the most part, don't accept that. And we say, you know, his theories there reflect the contemporary intellectual milieu more than the Torah's timeless teachings. They might be terms that are used to help convey Torah's teachings, but they themselves aren't Torah. And we don't allow the Rambam's outdated scientific explanations to distract us from his essential and his timeless lessons. And I think a similar thing with respect to Kuzari, and especially sort of his hierarchical categorization. As I mentioned before, it's a very Aristotelian perspective, even though the Kuzari was not enamored with Aristotle like the Rambam was. Maybe we could talk about that another time. But just because you don't embrace all aspects of the book and even certain aspects of his perspective on Bechiras Yisrael, there's no question that his mahalich on Bechiras Yisrael is one that would have a major impact on so many thinkers that would follow him. So the two thinkers that I said I would talk about today that I think are largely rooted in Kuzari, though again, they don't use his language. Very few thinkers after Kuzari, you know, talk about Inyan Eloki, but they do follow in his mahalech of assuming that there's something fundamentally different about the Jewish people. So we'll turn to the Maral for a moment. Again, we don't have much time left, but I just want to introduce it very briefly. So we talked about Maral actually already earlier in two shiurim ago. We talked about the reason for Bechira, the inscrutable nature of that decision. And I want to focus on a different point. There's a Gemara in Yevamos, same idea appears in many places in Shas, the opinion of Rav Shimon bar Yochai. Shimon bar Yochai said that Kivrei Ovdei Kochavim are not Metamei Ba'olel. In other words, even though a non-Jew would contract Tuma, let's say by Mago Masa, if you touched a non-Jewish corpse, you would become an Avat Tuma, but not through Tumas Ol. That's the view of Rav Shimon bar Yochai. And how does he learn it? It's from a pasuk in Yechezkel, Batem Tzonit Sonar Yisi Adam Atem. And Rav Shimon bar Yochai says, Atem Kriyin Adam, you, the Jewish people, are called Adam. Be'en Ovdei Kochavim Kriyim Adam. And since when it comes to Tumas Ohel, the pasuk says, Adam Ki Amus Ba'ohel, so therefore Kivrei Ovdei Kochavim are not Metamei Ba'ohel. That is what the Gemara says. And the question is, how, you know, when you see that at first, it almost sounds like we're saying that Umos Ha'olam are not Adam. They're like subhuman. They're not Adam. Atem Kriyim Adam, only the Jews. So how does that square with the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, Parak Gimel, where Rabbi Akiva said, Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzalem. Chiba Yisera Noda Shenivra B'Tzalem Shenemar Ki B'Tzalem Elokim Asas Adam. Yeah, Chaviv in Yisrael Shenikru Banim Hamakom. Vade Yisraelim have a Maila of being called Banim Hamakom, Banim Atem Lashem Elokeichem. But all human beings are chaviv because they're all nivra b'tzalem. In other words, it seems like a stira, right? It seems like a stira to what Shimon bar Yochai said. So how would we resolve that? So you could have three mahalchim, I think, bekitzer. One mahalich is to say takatz machlokas. Rabbi Akiva and Shimon bar Yochai disagree. It's a difficult mahalich because there's taka nafkamina. There are actually Tanayim who disagree with Rav Shimon bar Yochai and say there is Tumas Ohel for Gayim. According to Rabbeinu Tam, the Chachamim disagree with Rashbi, and the Shulchan Aruch and Ramah rule that l'chatchila you should taka b'choshesh for Rabbeinu Tam. That's why ideally a Kohen shouldn't be in an Ohel with a mace akum. But still, if Rabbi Akiva, if it was a stira, if this was a machlokas, you would expect Chazal or the Gemara or Rishonim to see it as a machlokas. I don't think that's the pashtas. So assuming it isn't a machlokas, so how do you resolve the two? So I'll tell you two mahalchim, and then I guess we'll have to stop there. One mahalich is in the Tiferes Yisrael. The Tosfos Yontif also says it. And they have a slightly different girsa in the Mishnah in Avos. It says, doesn't say Adam, it says Ha'adam. And according to at least one view in Tosfos and Yevamos, Samech Aleph, Rav Shimon bar Yochai agrees that Ha'adam doesn't exclude non-Jews. Adam does, but not Ha'adam. So Chaviv Ha'adam Shenivra B'Tzalem, that they're both true. Non-Jews are not called Adam, but they are called Ha'adam. And Tumas Tali in Shame Adam, so Tumas Tumas Ol, so Mimela, they're excluded from Tumas Ol. But there's nothing here that implies that they're subhuman. They're still called Ha'adam. They are Nivra B'Tzelem, therefore they're Chaviv. And the Tiferes Yisrael says nobody would ever imagine that non-Jews are subhuman. First of all, he says that the Pasuk says they were created B'Tzelem Elohim. Number two, he says that the Jewish people are called a treasure among nations, implying that other nations are also important. He says that if they were subhuman, why are they responsible for their actions? He says, you know, why is it that Chassidei Umos Ha'olam have a chelek in Olam Haba? So clearly, and we actually read a couple of weeks ago, you know, he talked about the tremendous contributions of non-Jews. So it's inconceivable that anyone would say that they're subhuman. And it's just, that's not what the Mishnah is saying. The Mishnah is saying that they're not Adam, but they are Ha'adam. That's the second Mahalich to resolve these two things. The third Mahalich is in the Maral. Again, many others say this as well, but we'll look at the Maral. It's in his Perishon Avos. The Av Sha'amar Chaviv Adam, Ein ze kol al kol min ha'adam. Ki kvar amru zal, ki atem kruyim adam, vein umos ta'olun kruyim adam. In other words, he says, look, there's a stira here. And the yishav is that when it says, chaviv adam shenivra b'tzelem, it's not kol al kol min adam. Ki lu shlemos habriya shehu la'adam befrat. Hu l'Yisrael v'lo l'umos. That Yisrael is considered the adam hashalem and not the umos. And he writes in Netzach Yisrael Perek Yud Aleph, "Im yimtza tov bahem hu b'mikra." In other words, the chiluk between the Jew and the non-Jew is that whether their accomplishments are inherent or b'mikra. For a Jew, it's inherent. That's why kol Yisrael yeshem chiluk l'maba. For a non-Jew, even if it happens, it's mikra. So chasidi umos olam, yes, it's shayach. So anything that's mikra doesn't always happen. So he doesn't deny the possibility for particular non-Jews to have achievements, but certainly he emphasizes the fundamental difference and that non-Jews are not considered fully Adam. Many Kabbalistic thinkers even go further and say, maybe the Maharal also would agree to this, that that even though once all humans had Tzelem Elokim, at a certain point in time, and presumably when at the time of Bechir Yisrael, this was lost, similar to what the Kuzari says about Inyan Eloki. So this is another mahalich. Now, when you see something like this, you sort of think, is the Maharal saying that non-Jews are unimportant or don't play a role in creation or something like that? But I don't think that's what he means. As we talked about in the previous shiurim, it's so clear that HaKadosh Baruch Hu cares about non-Jews and what they think and what they believe. Chilul Hashem is such a tremendous aveira, and that's Chilul Hashem b'fnei ha'amim, and as we see in Yechezkel. And you know, the Jews aren't destroyed because of Mayom Ragayim. So I don't think that the Maharal is denying any of that. But what he is saying is that there's a tremendous categorical spiritual chasm between Jew and non-Jew. And that brings us to Rav Kook. Rav Kook follows this Mahalich as well in emphasizing that difference. If you look at Orot Yisrael, which you have down here, Ha-Hevdel Shebein HaNeshama Yisraelis Atzmiusa Maviyah Pnimim Shifasa Tchunasa V'amadasa Uvein Nishmas Hagayim Kulam L'chol Dargoseyem Hu Yoser Gadol Ve'amok Me'avdel Shebein Nefesh Ha'adam V'nefesh HaBehema. So the distinction between the Nishama Yisraelis and the Nishmas Hagayim Kulam is more different than the difference between the Nefesh. There's a difference here between Nishama and Nefesh. Nishama is the higher level. The more supernal level, is bigger difference than the difference between the nefesh ha'adam and the nefesh of a behema. Shebein achronim rak hevdel kamuti nimtza. The difference between the nefesh adam and the nefesh behema is just kamuti. Aval bein arishonim shorer hevdel atzmi echuti. Whereas between the former, there's a difference that's qualitative, that's essential. So there's a fundamental difference in the Jewish neshama. And he says later on in that piece, it's not just a reflection of mitzvos, but in a certain sense, mitzvos are a reflection of it, almost the opposite. So that's a very, very strong type of sentence. But at the same time, Rav Kook writes, I guess we'll skip a little bit. First of all, he says the same chiluk as the Maharal, that that's for speaking generally, but not individuals. Individuals, a guy shows the Torah is like a Kohen Gadol, as the Gemara Sanhedrin says. And moreover, Rav Kook has, at the same time, tremendous universalism. If you take a look over here, we'll look at just two sources on this from Rav Kook, and then we'll stop. Rav Kook writes, Ani ohev es hakol, eini yachol shelo lehov es kol habrios, es kol ha'amim. So I love everything. I love all creations, all nations, all people. He says, I can't not love them. I can't not love them. Rotzeh ani b'chol me amke lev b'tifer sakol, b'takana sakol. Ahavti li Yisrael, ahavasi li Yisrael, hi yoser nil hava, yoser muka, aval achefetz hapnimi mitpashet hu b'izuz Havaso al kol mamish. Ein li kol tzorech l'chuf es haregesh ahavazos. I don't have to like squelch this love I have for all human beings. Hu noveya ashar me'omek hakodesh shal hachachma shal neshama alokis. And he says even more, there's a very famous poem or song. It's called Shir Merubah. I guess we'll close with this. Such an important peace. Yeshu shar shirat nafsho uvenafsho hu motzei es hakol es malei hasipuk haruchani b'miluo. So there's one person, there's the fellow who sings the song of his own soul. In himself he finds everything. V'yeshu shar shirat ha'uma. There's somebody who's a little more broad. He's not so narrow. He sings the song of the nation. Yotehu mitoch Hamagal al nafsho hapratis she'eno motzao sa meruchaves karaoi. It's too narrow, too constrained. Himself, his family. V'lo miyusheves yishuv ha'ideali sho'ef l'mormei oz. V'hu mizdabek ba'ava adina im klalusa shel Knesset Yisrael. So he connects to all of Klal Yisrael. We'll skip a little bit. V'yesh asher od Titrachev nafsho, ad shiotzei mitpashet me'al gvul Yisrael. He's even more broad than that. He doesn't just sing the song of his nation, but he sings the song of man. L'shir eshiras ha'adam, rucho holech umisrachev b'gaon klalus ha'adam, v'hod salmo. Sho'ef el te'udato ha'klalit, umitzapet l'hishtalmuto ha'elyona. So he looks for the perfection, and he cares about, and he loves, as we saw, all human beings. And then there's someone who's even broader than that. B'yesh asher hu od mizeh l'mala, v'rochav yitnasei, ad shemitached im kol hayikum kulo, im kol abrios, v'im kol olamim, v'im kulam hu omer shira. Zeh ha'osek b'perk shira b'chol yom, shemuvtach lo shu ben olam haba. So this is such a powerful poem, right? And we see such an incredible range. There's no stira between recognizing the unique spiritual potential of the Jew, which, as we see, Rav Kook emphasizes, and also caring about and having concern for all of humanity and honoring them, respecting them, appreciating them, and even loving them. And that shouldn't be seen as a stira. You know, if you think about it, let's say, in terms of our Parsha, Parsha Bereishis. So on the one hand, what Parsha Bereishis is all about is that everything comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore everything is holy, everything comes from Hashem. Everything is the creation of God, every single human being. And at the same time, the first parak of Bereishis talks about the various havdalos. It says havdalah five times. And Rav Kook is saying that we can't forget either of these. We can't forget the unity in creation, that everything is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, chaviv adam shenivra b'tzalem. And as such, we have to honor, respect, love, care for, appreciate every human being. And at the same time, we also have to remember the Havdalos and appreciate the uniqueness of the Jewish neshama and his spiritual capacity. Rav Kook thought that emphasizing that point was very important educationally. In the modern world, where it's something that's largely rejected, you hear over here, again, we don't have time to read it inside, but a letter in which he emphasizes the importance of teaching Asher b'charbanu mikol ha'amim. Lo rak mishunim anachnu mikol ha'amim, mishunim v'nivdalim b'chayim historiyim mitzuyanim, shein dugma b'chol am v'lashom, ki im gam me'ulim v'gdolim me'od mikol am. He said that's a very important thing to teach. If we would know how great we are, then we would become great. Rak b'shikchat atzmenu hinenu nisharim k'tanim b'shiflim v'shikchas atzmenu hi shikchas g'dulasenu. His student, Rav Huttner, actually was once asked, what is the message that we have to convey? That's by Machanech, he was asked, the most important message that we have to be Machanech to. And he said, Asher b'charbanu mikol ha'amim. But you could also go too far in that direction. As Rav Huttner's Talmud, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein stresses that emphasizing our chosenness must not undermine the humanity of every human being, and that Judaism has always insisted upon every human being's natural worth, his sanctity, his dignity, his personality. Every human being is majestic, is exalted, is summoned by God to perform a mitzvah, right? A mission, like it says in this week's parsha, that Hashem commanded man. And like us, non-Jews were created to serve God. They have a purpose. And recognizing and respecting their calling and their dignity and their humanity and their wisdom doesn't in any way have to undermine the singularity of our mission. And this really is the message, I think, that comes out even from the Maharal and Kuzari and Rav Kook, which is, again, oftentimes I think we're presented these ideas in very superficial, simplistic, you know, it's either somebody's a universalist or a particularist, or if you believe in the special neshama of the Jew, then you're sort of anti-Gayim or you're dismissive of Gayim. And Chas v'Shalom, that's not true. Rav Kook shows us that there's no stira between emphasizing the unique nature of the neshama of a Jew, but at the same time, that in no way should imply looking down upon, disparaging, not respecting, or denying the Tzelem Elokim of every human being. In other words, be'etzem, there's no stira between Atem Kriyam Adam and Chaviv Adam Shiniv Rabitzalem. And people like things to be simple and simplistic. So Memela, they see a stira, and they see that emphasizing the incredible capacity of the Jewish neshama somehow or another implies looking down upon or degrading the non-Jew. And that's not true. So even among the thinkers, and that's what the thinkers we've learned today, who do emphasize the uniqueness of the Jewish neshama, there's no reason why that mahalich should make us look down upon among Umos Olam. And that's really what I think we're also seeing in the first two shiurim of this unit. So we'll stop here. I'm sorry for going extra. Be'ezras Hashem, we'll pick up next week. Everyone should have a good Shabbos.
Good Shabbos.
Thank you,
Rabbi.
Thank you.
You're muted.
Can I have asked you, Shalom, Maria Blank.